Cracking jokes in Damascus today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump tweets that U.S. missiles, smart missiles, will soon be headed toward targets in Syria. But in Damascus, people are going about their daily lives and even writing punchlines.
Mr. Trump said that the missiles are going to be smart. So people are saying, oh, if this, the missiles are going to be as smart as Donald Trump, then the whole world must be worried.
Plus, former President Jimmy Carter on why his new book is called Faith.
We've lost faith in freedom. We've lost faith in the value of telling the truth. We've lost faith in personal integrity. We've lost faith in some of the principles that have made us a successful democracy.
That and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. We saw the fire and fury tweets from President Trump last year, putting the crosshairs on North Korea. Big exhale that nothing happened and we haven't had to witness a war on the Korean Peninsula. Now Trump's tweeting about Syria and warning Russia that, as he put it, some nice new smart U.S. missiles are on their way. The president, as you know, is weighing a military response to that apparent chemical attack on Syrian civilians this weekend. It happened in Douma, the last rebel stronghold in eastern Ghouta near Damascus. Since then, the rebels have surrendered and thousands of residents have been evacuated. Like I said, Douma is just 10 miles from the center of Syria's capital, Damascus. So we wanted to check back in with Namat, a longtime Damascus resident we've had on the show before. And as before, we've agreed not to use her full name. So what is your response to the saber rattling from Washington right now?
Okay. Actually, I'm one of many people here in Syria, especially in Damascus. I can talk about Damascus because it's my city where I live.
Yeah.
In general, life is quite normal today. Children went to school. People went to work just like any other normal day. I went to my work also. I went to the gym. Very, very normal day. People are just talking about it. They are making a lot of fun of the whole thing. They are cracking jokes all the time.
They're joking about
it. Some people were saying, yes, a lot of jokes about it.
Like what?
To be honest. Mr. Trump said that the missiles are going to be smart. So people are saying, oh, if the missiles are going to be as smart as Donald Trump, then the whole world must be worried. And many, many other jokes like, okay, let's get ready. Today we will prepare our popcorn and sit on the roof and watch the missiles coming. Some people are taking it a little bit seriously by starting to keep extra food at home, especially bread and rice, which is quite normal at such kind of situations. Some people get a little bit worried. Others are just living a normal life.
I got to say, I'm a little surprised to hear that because we see reports today that some commercial airlines have rerouted their flights away from Syrian airspace, worried about these threats coming from Washington. And that hasn't put people in Damascus on edge?
No, not at all. Not in Damascus. Even in other governorates, like I have colleagues from work, we have different offices all around Syria, and they are all cracking jokes on Facebook.
Have you heard anybody in Damascus say they support the idea of some kind of attack or retaliation?
Actually, despite that kind of sense of humor that we are having and the sarcasm, people are quite angry, very upset. Of course, we totally differentiate between American people and the American administration. I have to make this very clear.
What specifically are you hearing? Why are you upset?
Not only me. Okay, imagine this. Suppose you don't like Donald Trump. Would you like Russia to hit your army? An American airbase or an American military base or something? Would you like that as an American citizen?
Nama, what if that president is suspected of killing his own people?
What about George Bush? Didn't he kill millions of Iraqis and thousands of American soldiers were killed in a war that we discovered later that it was just for money and oil? So still, would you like your army to be hit by a stranger? That's the question. As an American citizen, I'm talking again.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, this is our land, our territories. Those Syrian soldiers, our people. And of course, we will not like America to come and hit. And again, let the U.S., you know, the U.S. administration should understand that they should not be so arrogant at the end of the day. They are not the owners of the world. They are just the kings of the war. They're just what about Security Council? Why they are meeting in the Security Council if they are going to hit anyway? Where is the international law?
So, Namad,
what about all of this?
As to the report of a chemical weapons attack in Douma, Russian officials apparently went to Douma, tested samples taken from the area, and concluded there was no chemical weapons attack. Russia has also said the West is saying there was chemical weapons as a pretext for war. Syria denies it. The UN believes it did happen. Are you getting any information you trust about what happened in Douma last weekend?
Okay, a lot of NGOs, local NGOs, are working near Douma now, receiving those people who are from East Ghouta and from Douma. They are receiving those people who are coming out. Some of them, they want to go to collective shelters. Others, they want to go to Jarablus to be evacuated to the northern part of Syria, to go to the Jarablus area. So people who are standing there from these local NGOs did not notice any people who are coming out with any symptoms of being attacked by chemical weapons. The Syrian Red Crescent and the International Red Cross are there. And the Syrian Red Crescent is a very reputable non-governmental organization here in Syria. And the Syrian Red Crescent is one of the partners of the United Nations also. So the Syrian Red Crescent confirmed that there are no people who are coming out with any symptoms of being attacked by chemical weapons. And have you seen the videos? Have you seen those rescuers and wet helmets standing there, no masks, no suits, etc., and they are just spraying people who are attacked?
I've also seen overwhelming video evidence of people trying very hard to breathe, people not moving.
Exactly, but
bodies,
have you seen videos that were leaked from the white helmets, etc., showing how they are videographing these kind of things and they are just acting?
Namad, I don't really want to debate with you whether there was chemical weapons or not. I'd really like to know, especially with these tweets from the White House, where do you place your hope for an end to the violence in Syria?
I hope that just Russia and America start to talk diplomatically and patch up, because this is a problem now between America and Russia. It has nothing to do with Syria. This time, the U.S. administration is accusing Russia of using chemical weapons, and we all know the story about that Russian spy, etc., and how things escalated. So now it's just between U.S. and Russia. It has nothing to do with Syria this time.
And let me ask you one final question, Namad. As a Syrian whose country is now in the crosshairs, how does that make you feel that this seems to be a conflict between the U.S. and Russia at this point?
It makes me feel angry, because we are peaceful people. We are the kind of people who are very resilient. We love life. Even in the worst of situation, we try to have fun. We try to live our life, to maintain a normal life as much as possible. So we want to live, and we want this to end. If Russia and America are having a problem, let them go and fight together. It has nothing to do with us. Why are they fighting in our country? Why making Syria their playground?
Namat is a resident of Damascus. A minute ago, she raised the issue of the legality of any military action by an outside power like the United States. I asked Ona Hathaway about that. She's a professor of international law at Yale. Ona, let's start with the basics. The U.S. operates under two sets of laws when it comes to military action, U.S. law and international law. So the U.S. context first. How is military action against Syria justified under U.S. law and the Constitution?
Well, the problem is that it's not. Here, the problem is that the president would be taking action against Assad, presumably, and that doesn't fall within any pre-existing authorizations by Congress for the use of force. So under the U.S. Constitution, he would have to go back to Congress and seek congressional authorization for any use of force directly against the Assad government. This doesn't fall under the existing authorizations, for instance, to go after terrorist groups within Syria, which is the authority that the U.S. is currently operating under in Syria. So he'd have to get additional authorization.
Is there any justification coming from the executive branch of government to launch an attack like this? I mean, didn't Barack Obama and his legal team in 2013 consider a military response when there was that chemical strike in Syria?
Yeah, so there hasn't been any word from the legal team, and they haven't given any clear answers as to why they think that this would, in fact, be legal. Presumably, if they were to do so, the argument would be something like, we have acted before in situations where it's in the national interest of the United States, in particular where it's important for regional stability and other international aims. That is a justification that many, in fact, I think most constitutional law scholars would say is much too broad, and that, in fact, isn't justified under the U.S. Constitution, that in this case, it would be necessary for him to go back to Congress.
Right. Under the Constitution, Congress alone has the power to declare war. What's curious, though, is that the U.S. hasn't done so, hasn't declared war through Congress since 1941, and there have been plenty of wars since then. So Vietnam, Cambodia, Panama, Grenada, Desert Storm in 1991, has it all been war by presidential directive?
Well, so it's true that there haven't been declarations of war, but it either Congress has to declare war or it has to authorize war through other means. And so it can authorize war just through passing ordinary legislation, which is typically the way in which it authorizes war today. So nearly all of the military operations against terrorist groups around the world that are happening right now are under what's called the 2001 Authorization for Use of Military Force. This was a authorization passed by Congress shortly after the 9/11 attacks,
right,
which authorized military operations.
But
this
against
Al-Qaeda
and its affiliates.
Exactly, against Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. And of course, Assad is not an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. So this falls outside the scope of that pre-existing authorization.
So let's look now at the issues around international law. And it might be a good time to remind everybody that war is illegal under international law, right?
That's right. So under the United Nations Charter, states may not use force against one another. And that's the core prohibition of the UN Charter regime. There are some exceptions. There's an exception if a state is acting in its own self-defense. There's an exception if the state that is the recipient of the use of force consents to it. And there's an exception if the Security Council has authorized the use of force. None of those exceptions apply here. And so the prohibition remains in place, and the president would be clearly violating international law if he were to take action.
Then how can the U.S. defend any decision to attack Syria under international law? Can it?
I don't think that it can. I think that the only argument you might hear made would be a version of a humanitarian intervention argument, or sometimes referred to as a responsibility to protect argument. The problem with that is that is best understood as permitting the use of force when authorized by the Security Council, not in violation of the UN Charter, that it's not a shadow exception to the Security Council's required authorization for humanitarian intervention, but that it in fact allows the Security Council to authorize intervention for humanitarian purposes. Of course, the Security Council hasn't acted here, and so that would not be permitted.
I mean, some would say a response based on humanitarian considerations is actually what's needed right now. We think about these children in Douma who are believed to have been poisoned. I mean, don't they deserve a response, some kind of
help? Yes, they absolutely do. And it's incredibly heartbreaking. And the real sad situation here is that the ways in which we normally would respond, which is through the Security Council, has been shut down by the Russians. So there have been several attempts to have the Security Council act, to intervene, to address these problems in many different forms. And Russia has either vetoed or threatened to veto every one of them. And that has shut off a lot of the legal channels for doing something here, which is really an incredible tragedy.
Yale Law Professor Ona Hathaway, co-author of The Internationalist, How a Radical Plan to Outlaw War Remade the World. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Just ahead on the show, how Russia sees the U.S. threat to Syria and the suspected chemical attack there. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Still on the Syria story and the threat to attack Syria from the White House, The World's Charles Maines joins us from Moscow. So remind us what the Russian government had to say about the suspected chemical attack in the Syrian city of Douma over the weekend, Charles.
You know, Russia categorically denies that Assad's forces carried out this attack in Douma. They've called for a dispassionate investigation into the incident. And this really fits with this idea that gets promoted a lot in Russia, that the White Helmets, this group of activists in Syria, that really these are actors. They fake these scenes of rescue and these chemical attacks. And these are really designed to provide a pretext for U.S. airstrikes. So Russia's long held this view that Assad has no chemical weapons, that Assad gave them up after Russia helped broker a deal with the Obama administration back in 2013. And they look at this very much in line with the poisoning of Skripal, this former double agent in the UK. You know, in all these situations, there's a sense that the fix is in, that people are rushing to point the finger at, well, in this case, Assad and Russia and Iran. Certainly, when you watch the way that the war is covered here in Moscow, it's a parallel universe.
So President Trump, as you know, broke from his pattern after the chemical attack and directly criticized both Russian President Putin and Syrian President Assad, saying there would be, quote, a big price to pay. And today, one of Trump's tweets suggested a military confrontation. How has Moscow been reacting to this?
Well, Russia has warned that a U.S. strike on Syria would have, quote, grave consequences, very much in line with what Trump originally tweeted. But by and large, we've seen Russia kind of take the high road, at least so far. We heard from Dmitry Peskov, this is Putin's spokesman today, saying that any U.S. attack, he hoped it wouldn't happen, but it would substantially destabilize this already fragile situation in the Middle East. He said that Russia's role was not to engage in Twitter diplomacy, kind of a knock on Mr. Trump, but only engage in serious talks. We also heard from Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova. She said that smart missiles should fly towards terrorists, not towards the lawful government of Assad. Of course, she's referencing this comment by President Trump in his own tweet that smart missiles would be flying towards Syria in the near future.
So almost a year ago, Trump ordered a missile strike on a Syrian airbase that was believed to be responsible for another chemical attack. The U.S. warned Russia, and Russia did not try to shoot down the missiles. Even though Russia has said in no uncertain terms that they'll respond forcefully if the U.S. responds, do you think something similar could play out this time?
Well, it's certainly possible. I mean, the U.S. warned Russia under this existing deconfliction agreement that they have between the two militaries. This is the idea of preventing U.S. and Russian forces from attacking one another in Syria. But if we go back to that April missile strike, there were also questions at the time as to whether the Russian military then tipped off the Assad regime about the impending attacks. You know, the U.S. basically bombed empty military runways. They destroyed a few planes. But, you know, the strikes were, by most people's accounts, fairly ineffective in terms of degrading Assad's forces. So you have to wonder, you know, if that goes into this U.S. decision-making process this time.
Is Russia's involvement in Syria playing well domestically with Russians? And do you think Russia actually wants to avoid an escalation?
Well, you know, the war was playing well for quite a long time, but now if you go for independent polls, only a third of Russians support continuing the operation. A majority say they want it to end. And frankly, Vladimir Putin wants it to end. He's tried twice to bring the troops home. He had this kind of mission accomplished moment. You know, if you can recall when George W. Bush went to that aircraft carrier after the Iraq invasion, it was very similar. He went to the Russian military base in December, said that basically they'd secured the conditions for peace talks, that they'd accomplished what they were supposed to do, and the troops were going home. Well, it hasn't worked out that way. And certainly these efforts to push forward peace talks and negotiations have not played all that well either. And meanwhile, this Russian coalition with Turkey and Iran has been really strained. You have Israel getting involved in carrying out airstrikes against Iran. So, you know, it just keeps getting messier and messier.
The world's Charles Maines in Moscow. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's A-side, B-side time again, which is part of Future Folk, our partnership with Smithsonian Folkways. So for the A-side, as you may know, the world's Brandy Fullwood takes a track from the Smithsonian Archives. Then she toggles over to something she's been listening to lately, and that's the B-side. Today's A-side, B-side is about structure and ritual.
How do you create structure? Possibly a lot of rituals, persistence, organization, and deep breaths. It's a lot like developing a rhythm. In 2002, the Smithsonian put out The Silk Road, a musical caravan. They ask, what if Marco Polo had a tape recorder? And legal speculations aside, the album captures rich sounds from Turkey, Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, and Xinjiang, China. Dicker is the 19th track. It's sung by the Naqshbandi Afghi Brotherhood. This performance is a ritual practice particular to Sufis, but in Central Asia, it's also performed by shamans and by groups of non-Sufi Muslims. This is just an excerpt of 2 hours of performance. Uttering secret words cut with rhythmic breathing while other groups stir in spiritual cantation. It's a devotion created by several exertions from the body. It's contained, patterned, and it trudges along. The singers trickle their voices into forceful humming, Together they seem to brush over a surface. It is swift and clean, cutting fine lines over melodies and percussions in the mouth. This structure, not this ritual, reminded me of Concello de Baume's Senso by Tullio. There's a structure in this B-side song that also strikes the surface. The words rush to fit inside stanzas and are punctuated by breaths and wrapped by a slap. Just like the A-side, as the song goes on, there's a faint exertion. And then it builds almost like easily winning a tug of war, the strength building with each movement forward.
Vou me colocar no meu lugar, vou me recolher pra te privar de ver o estrago que ficou, de sentir o cheiro do horror.
They sing, I'm going to put myself in my place. I will recompose myself to avoid that fatigue from time to time. Unlike the A side, the strike does not become harsher. The breath on the ends of each sentence shifts from cascading into a controlled gasp. Okay, it's a lot of control and singing from the stomach, but that patience and persistence to hold on to notes in between time and structure is exactly how I connected these two songs. Approaching new seasons, especially now, I anticipate the dewy air, a light blue haze with a yellow wash from the sun, dampened soil and bright greens. But I'm also reminded of the need to find beauty in renewal and ritual. To bask in persistence and grow, finding new strengths and rhythm.
Vou me colocar no meu lugar, vou me recolher pra te privar.
For the world, I'm Brandi Fullwood.
Que ficou de sentir o cheiro do ouro. Vou me colocar no meu lugar, vou me recolher pra te privar de ver o estrago que ficou de sentir o cheiro do ouro. Segura na âncora e pula no mar.
Conselho do Bom Senso is the title of this track. It's by Tullio. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Doris Paul was seeing too many women from indigenous communities going to prison, so she decided to change the system.
They put down the bottle, they put down the drug, the needle, and they picked up a drum and a drumstick, and they're drumming and participating in our ceremonies.
Restorative justice in British Columbia. That's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Let's get back to our look at what life's like for women in prison around the globe. We've been taking a long look at this here on the show. Our Cross Women's Lives project has brought us stories exploring why the number of women behind bars is growing, both here and in other countries. A lot of it has to do with harsh sentences for drug-related offenses. Today, what it takes to help women stay out of prison. In Canada, it's Indigenous women who are far more likely to end up incarcerated. And to deal with that, Canada's justice system has expanded to include what's known as restorative justice. In this case, that means making Indigenous culture part of rehabilitation and reform. Here's The World's Andrea Crossan, and let me just say that you may find parts of the story disturbing.
Doris Paul is not a hugger. She's one of the warmest people you could meet. But Doris doesn't like to show emotion. She says she almost never cries. Because when Doris was a child, not crying was the only thing she could do to fight back.
I learned not to give them the satisfaction of crying at a young age. I wouldn't let them see me cry. I would just feel the pain and roll up in a ball.
Doris is Indigenous. She's a member of the Squamish Nation. When she was a child, she was taken to a residential school where she was educated by Catholic nuns and priests.
I knew right away when I got there at the age of six that it was evil.
The Canadian government forced Indigenous families to surrender their children to these schools. Kids were punished for speaking their language and practicing their beliefs. The system broke families and broke communities. It nearly broke Doris.
And I'm going to be very direct, very honest in this. I was beaten so bad at the age of 6 where I would crumple on the floor and just stay there until the pain stopped. And at the age of 9, I was raped by the priest. And I remember at the young age of 9 trying to commit suicide because of what happened to me.
It's no wonder Doris started drinking when she was a teenager. She used alcohol to numb her pain. And she's not the only one who was dealing with this kind of trauma. Over 150,000 Indigenous children were forced into residential schools. Many suffered emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. The last school closed in the 1990s, but the legacy of that system, it lives on throughout Canada, arguably no place more clearly than the criminal justice system. Doris Paul eventually got her life together. She stopped drinking, earned a degree in social work, and now she works for the local police department. And at 61, she's an elder in her community. Doris is small, but she strides up the steps here at the North Vancouver Provincial Courthouse. She's been coming here for years.
I used to sit in the gallery.
Doris would watch the court proceedings.
And I remember interrupting.
Because she could see the disconnect between the justice system and many of the defendants.
Some of our nation members were doing really good. Like, they did finally find healing. They found treatment or found their place, you know, back into the culture. But the judge didn't know it.
She would ask to address the judge.
I put my hand up and I said, you know, I really want to speak on behalf of the cultural part of the First Nations people. So I spoke on behalf of that person, and then it became a real keen interest, you know.
And Doris, with the help of that judge and community leaders, created this.
Do you have any cream here?
A First Nations court that convenes once a month, where 5 elders work with a judge to really understand what led to each person being sentenced to commit the crime.
Tsitsitsiam, Heavenly Father, the Queen Matau, pity us.
Eugene Henry is Doris's brother-in-law, and he's one of the elders. He offers a prayer before court convenes.
Opening prayers, asking the Creator to come down upon us to ease our minds, to calm our anger, and listen to the words that are set on the table.
Okay, good. He's doing well. Okay, I'll appear for him.
First Nations Court works within the existing justice system with offenders who have already admitted their guilt and self-identify as Indigenous. In the courtroom, the judge sits at a table with the lawyers and the offender. The elders sit in a semicircle near the judge. Throughout the sentencing hearings, there are moments of tears and moments of laughter. One woman sits in front of the judge and the elders waiting to be sentenced for theft. The woman says she was stealing and selling baby formula to support her cocaine addiction. She tells the court that she's clean now and she's working as a full-time babysitter for her daughter. At this point, one of the elders tells her that she knows her, that they knew each other when they were kids. The two women laugh together and share stories. Then the woman is sentenced. She receives 12 months probation, and she's banned from going into the store she stole from. Outside of court, she's visibly relieved.
It was wonderful. It was really heartfelt. Like, people had compassion. It was like one big family sitting there talking. Even the judge, like, just jumped right in there, you know, and he was family too, kind of thing, right, which was wonderful.
The woman, who asked not to be named, says that substance abuse had consumed her life for decades.
By the time I was 15, I was an alcoholic. And no one told me that the substance abuse would carry me to a place that would be very dark and lonely. You're sitting under a dark cloud and you can't seem to escape it.
But like Doris Paul, she says her troubles stem back to when she was a child.
I was in residential school and it was a horrible, horrible experience. And the government was closing his eyes, ignoring the fact that children were being abused. I was abused for the whole time I was there, beaten and everything.
For so many Indigenous women, the trauma is just so deep. Even the prosecution recognizes it. Arlene Loist is the Crown Counsel, the prosecutor assigned to First Nations Court.
The incarceration rate for Aboriginal women is completely out of whack. And if you look at a lot of their crimes, it's as a result of poverty and neglect and abuse. And so if you do look at it holistically, it's more likely we can get help, and it's to get them out of that cycle.
There hasn't been research done yet on whether courts like this can stop that revolving door of reoffending. And this court is fairly new. It was only created 5 years ago. But for Doris Paul, the elder who helped create this court, it's just part of the solution. She says that to really succeed, offenders need to reconnect with their indigenous culture, a culture that Doris wants me to witness for myself. She invites me to come as her guest to a traditional ceremony at the Longhouse. In the back of her van, she shows me a black robe covered with small carved cedar canoe paddles.
And here is a paddle jacket. We wear this as part of the regalia. Our ancestors used otter, but we replaced it with velvet.
She applies a black paint onto her face. It's made of the root of the Devil's Club plant.
That's our protection. In the Sion world, it protects us from what we believe is like a bad spirit. Then we're covered with the good spirit.
Doris says the culture is the medicine.
I can sit in this ceremony today and I can see how many people I've helped through the culture. And they've put down the bottle, they put down the drug, the needle, and they picked up a drum and a drumstick, and they're drumming and participating in our ceremonies. So it's really important to remind First Nations people that they come from somewhere, they belong somewhere.
As we approach the Longhouse, Doris's nephew Aaron greets us.
Hi, Auntie, how are you?
I'm good.
I love you.
I love you too.
Hi.
Hi, Andrea. So nice to
Andrea,
meet you.
Andrea, my name is Aaron.
Nice to meet you.
Aaron. Nice to meet you too. Yeah.
There's a nail on the doorframe.
We touch the nail because when we walk in the door, this is where you leave your outside thinking. So you keep your mind focused on what's happening here.
Yeah.
We touch the nail. And Doris leads me in to witness the healing. For The World, I'm Andrea Crossan, North Vancouver.
Tomorrow, Andrea spends the day with another remarkable woman working to help break the cycle of incarceration. Mo Korchinski knows what it takes to help women stay out of prison because she's been there herself.
How many times were you incarcerated?
I was in an I did 4 fairly long sentences. I did a year, 11 months, 15 months, and then 18 months sentence. So I did a fairly long bit.
She used to sell cocaine to support her own addiction. Now she runs a program to help women when they need it the most, those first few days on the outside.
What our program can offer women coming out of prison is hope. That somebody like me who used to be a permanent fixture at the prison, I have my children in my life, I have my grandchildren in my life, you know, I got my bachelor's, I went back and got educated. They too can do that.
Getting out and staying out. That's tomorrow here on The World. This was 15 years ago this week.
Dramatic breaking news. We have had reliable reports of the scenes which George Bush was hoping for, jubilation on the streets of Baghdad.
The American Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has described the scenes as U.S. forces swept into the Iraqi capital Baghdad as breathtaking and historic.
Saddam Hussein is now taking his rightful place alongside Hitler, Stalin, Lenin, Trotsky.
As the American troops sweep through Baghdad from numerous directions, the people of the city are beginning to show their belief that the Iraqi government effectively exists only in name in large parts of the capital.
The regime is in disarray. The regime is losing control. The regime no longer has control over certain...
Serious disorder has continued on the streets of Baghdad, with the presence of American troops doing little to deter the widespread looting.
That was Baghdad this week in 2003. Of course, with hindsight, we know which news stories to highlight from the first days of the Baghdad invasion. Those first 3 days of the war were kind of a preview for what would follow. Kurdish journalist Ayub Nouri was in Iraq in 2003, working with Western media, including The World. He joins us now. Ayub, you were not just working, but as an Iraqi, you watched as tens of thousands of American troops and others poured into Iraq. What did that feel like to you?
It felt great. I remember hanging out with U.S. soldiers in different parts of Iraq, in Mosul, in Kirkuk, in Tikrit, in Baghdad. And I really, not as a journalist, but as an Iraqi Kurd who had suffered so much under Saddam Hussein's regime, I welcomed those troops. And I was happy that a powerful army had come to Iraq to remove Saddam Hussein and his regime.
So there was that famous emblematic toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein that happened on April 9th, 2003. And then the wholesale looting, we just heard a bit of that just 2 days later. What were Iraqis saying about those days?
I was in Kirkuk on April 10th, the day after Saddam Hussein's statue was toppled in Baghdad. A similar statue was removed in Kirkuk. And I was there and I saw people celebrating. And also, I witnessed the looting. And I remember some of the Arab media were saying, oh, these looters are not Iraqis. They have been brought in by the U.S. Iraqis don't do that kind of thing. But that, they were Iraqis. I saw them. I talked to them. And they were looting mainly institutions or buildings or offices, whatever that symbolized the regime. They did not go to loot someone else's home. It was some kind of revenge in a way.
What did you think about the looting? How did you react to it at the time?
The looting, I think, was okay. I didn't really mind that part, whatever they stole from the palaces or army bases. But some people went too far. They looted hospitals or schools. What made me sad mainly was breaking down doors and windows and things that the country had to pay for later on.
So you said that it felt great to kind of be with those American troops. How long did that great feeling for you last?
I still believe that it was good that the American army invaded Iraq and removed Saddam Hussein's regime. But then later, as I started reporting on sectarian violence and the fight between American troops and Iraqi Sunni resistance, I saw so much bloodshed and violence in different parts of the country. I started to kind of feel bad to see so much destruction.
So the Sunni resistance and the U.S. surge against it became the big narrative kind of in the central and southern part of Iraq. But you were in northern Iraq. What was the story where you were in the north?
In the north of Iraq, people were even happier that the United States decided to remove Saddam Hussein's regime because the Kurds had suffered and lost hundreds of thousands of civilians to Saddam's rule. And we had been living in a self-rule autonomous region for 12 years, which was created under the U.S. and U.K. protection in 1991. So 12 years before the U.S. invasion of 2003, the Kurds had enjoyed semi-autonomy and security and stability. So when the Americans came and removed Saddam Hussein in 2003, the Kurds suddenly found themselves even 12 years ahead of the rest of Iraq. There was no sectarian violence or anything else.
Ayub, 5 years from now, what would you like to see happening in Iraq?
5 years from now, I hope there will be no more war, because I witnessed most of it as a kid, as a journalist, as a reporter, as a traveler. I've seen all of it. All my whole life, Iraq has been at war with itself or with one of its neighbors. So in 5 years from now, I really hope there is no more war or bloodshed. People and families and mothers should not lose any more children to this violence.
Kurdish journalist Ayub Nouri with us on the 15th anniversary of the U.S.-led ground invasion of Baghdad. He's an editor at Rudaw English, the Iraqi Kurdish news service. Ayub, thank you as always.
Thank you very much.
By any measure, these are strange times we're living in.
All over the world, there is a lack of faith in things which we used to cherish.
The unmistakable voice of former President Jimmy Carter there. The more time elapses from his presidency, Carter says, the more he's interested in exploring the spiritual side of life. That's why he's written a new book, his 32nd book. It's called Faith, A Journey for All. In it, Carter explores what he sees as an erosion of faith all around him.
You know, faith in democracy, faith in freedom, faith in God, faith in ourselves, faith in our neighbors, you know, faith in other people, faith in the future. And so I thought it was time for me to express as best I could the various aspects of faith and explain how faith, particularly on a religious basis, is unchanged and that we can all cherish it and derive a great deal of solace and help and, I think, strength from retaining our faith.
You've been described as a progressive evangelical. Has President Trump's popularity among evangelicals surprised you?
Well, his sustained popularity among evangelicals has. I think some of that popularity or trust has been shaken lately by the allegations about extramarital affairs and things of that kind. But I think every evangelical is searching for a proper relationship with God and with people around us. And I believe that we'll see, perhaps in the election in 2018, some loss of that, political confidence.
You also write in your book about the increase in Islamophobia in our country. And in the past few weeks, many Muslim Americans have spoken out to say they're worried that President Trump's choice for National Security Advisor John Bolton is affiliated with anti-Muslim hate groups. And they're worried that Trump's pick to lead the State Department, Mike Pompeo, that he sees the fight against terrorism as a sort of holy war. Are these men's beliefs, their attitudes about Islam, cause for concern?
Well, they'll cause me concern, but, I don't know about their other acquaintances. I don't know most of the men, of course. But obviously, I believe we need to look with love, according to the teachings of Jesus Christ, not only on our own neighbors and friends and those who love us back and how lovable, but even to those from whom we might be estranged, or even our enemies, or those who hurt us. So the overwhelming concept of love is the one thing that I put in the book, finally in the final pages of it, that even transcends the importance of faith itself.
Just on the main news of today, President Trump is threatening some sort of attack on Syria after its alleged chemical attack on civilians. You've been in the hot seat before where you have to weigh a response to aggression. What occurs to you today?
Well, I personally was able, luckily, to maintain our country at peace for 4 years when I served as president, and to promote other human rights as well. I think that living in peace is one of the basic human rights. So I think whenever we go to a war against other people, particularly when it doesn't meet the basic standards of a just war, which has been inherited down ever since the time of ancient times, I think we depart from our basic principles of religion. So my hope is that we can escape from the present entanglements that the United States maintains from the urge to go to war and to go to combat. This could possibly lead, in some cases, including our relationships with Russia and with North Korea, to the use of nuclear weapons, which would be a devastating thing to happen maybe to every living thing on Earth. So I had to face this when I was president, and I prayed more when I was president than I did any other time in my life, that I could maintain peace and the other basic human rights.
Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says we are closer to fascism than ever. What do you think about that? Do you agree with her?
Well, I believe that the United States has been able, because of our basic character as a nation and as a people, to overcome great handicaps and challenges in the past. Slavery and the Civil War and the right of women to vote equally with men and the end of racial segregation, which persisted for almost 100 years. So I think in the past we have proven as a country that we can overcome any major challenge that presents itself. So I have confidence or faith in the future of America.
What is your take, though, on the rise of nationalism and populism, not just in the U.S., but around the world? I mean, is this era anything but normal?
I think it probably is a greater challenge because we lose faith in the basic things that I mentioned earlier. We've lost faith in freedom. We've lost faith in the value of telling the truth. We've lost faith in personal integrity. We've lost faith in some of the principles that have made us a successful democracy. And the same thing happened in other countries. The Carter Center has conducted or monitored 107 different challenges or difficult elections, trying to bring peace and freedom to people and give them a right to choose their own leaders. So I think that down through history, I read a lot of history books, we have seen major challenges to the principles that we should hold dear. And I believe that we have the resilience and the almost instant communications that where we get to know each other better in these days. I think we have the capabilities within ourselves and in relationship with others to overcome these challenges.
I would love to know where you get the optimism from, because people I know in the news business who are following this every day, some people are freaking out. Is it your faith that gives you this optimism?
I get it basically from my religious faith. So I think the ultimate fate of human beings is going to be favorable. We just have to have confidence in ourselves, confidence in others, or faith in one another. And be resilient and forceful and let each one of us individually do what we know is right and fair and that are principles that have guided us and guided all the great religions.
So the office of the presidency itself, people who know the White House, are kind of shocked by all the firings and departures and the reports of chaos. I mean, we hear the presidency changes a person. How did it change you? And do you think the office might ultimately have the same impact on President Trump?
Well, it made me feel more responsible and more responsibility on myself. And it made me be much more aware of the needs of not only a few other people in my own circle of personal acquaintances, but I had 3 million people, for instance, working for me when I was president of the United States, who were amenable to my decisions. So I had a much greater feeling of need for guidance and a need for clinging to my basic faith in myself and other people and in the future of humankind, as well as democracy and freedom. So that's what sustained me, and I hope it will be a sustaining factor in the life of the President of the United States and future presidents as well.
President Carter, thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you, Marco.
Definitely not the same White House today. Lots to think about there from the 93-year-old former president. And that'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back here with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.